This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and today I'm bringing you an episode about all of Trump's legal troubles. I actually recorded this episode with Perry Stein of The Washington Post a few weeks ago. It's still up to date, but we held it because there was so much breaking political and legal news, as you all well know. So Perry Stein covers the Justice Department and the FBI for The Washington Post, as I said. She previously covered DC education. Before she joined the Post in 2015, she was a staff writer for the Washington City Paper and wrote for the Miami Herald. I hope this helps to give you a quick update on where the Trump cases are now. We will certainly be following these and other political and legal developments. So today, I'm thrilled to say that we are joined by Perry Stein. She covers the Justice Department and the FBI for the Washington Post, or as she just described it to me, Trump with a side of Biden. Perry, thank you for joining us. Thank you for passing judgment. I'm excited to dive into mostly the Mar-a-Lago case today.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
So I think there's been so much news about the Mar-a-Lago case, and people are generally aware of the fact that there are criminal cases pending against the former president. And people might have gotten lost because we talk about the New York case, we talk about the DC election interference case, there's also a Georgia election interference case. Can you bring us all the way back to basics and just remind us, what is this case in Florida about?
Right. Now, this is the case that, you know, the Washington Post, me and my colleagues have reported that I think Trump and his team are most afraid of. And it is widely viewed as the most serious charges against him and perhaps even the strongest case. So this is a case in which Trump is charged with about 40 charges of taking government material, specifically sensitive government materials marked as classified, from the White House to Mar-a-Lago after he left office. And then once he wasn't president and government officials tried to retrieve them, he is charged with and alleged to have obstructed and intentionally hindered their efforts to retrieve those materials.
It's really helpful to remind ourselves before we jump into Judge Eileen Cannon and what did she say about the special counsel, what we're talking about here. And in laying out the basics of the case, I'm reminded that, of course, we're not talking about the only former president who had classified documents where he shouldn't have had them. I'm not asking you to put a judgment call on this, but could you remind us of how the case against former President Trump is different than the situation of how the documents were found in President Biden's office and residence and Vice President Pence's residence as well? Because we did seem to have this kind of flurry of classified documents being found in either current president or former vice president residences. And I think people felt maybe like, well, why is Trump being charged and others aren't?
The basic is simple. These are drastically simple, different cases. They all did have government materials in their possession, those three people that you talked about. The biggest difference, right, is that they gave them back when they were found, right? I mean, you can look at Biden's and we can look at the special counsel report, and they were basically, there was some evidence that he did come across some of it at some point and decided to keep it. But that still is very different from what Trump did, which is they gave him a subpoena. And I mean, I think it starts even before that. NARA, the archive agency, was trying to give them back. Then the DOJ got involved. They asked for a subpoena, meaning a document, a government, a court ordered document saying, give us back these documents. And he didn't. And then they executed a search warrant. And even then, when the subpoena came, the allegations are that, you know, he moved around boxes because they didn't want to give them all back. And that's when they executed a search warrant and they got additional boxes of government materials that included the classified documents. So, I mean, what's interesting about the 40 charges, a lot of them relate to the retention of a specific classified document, it has to really be that you willfully retained it. So let's say you're a government worker with a clearance and you, you know, forget that you have a top secret document and you bring it with you. I don't know. I heard an example like, you know, someone left it in their car and then they went to McDonald's and it was still in their car, some fast food restaurant. Now, that would be a harder thing to charge a case that he illegally retained that material, because did he intentionally do it? Because you need to have intention in these charges. Now, that person that I mentioned, that hypothetical case of this person leaving these materials in his car, he could very clearly have lots of professional consequences and say, you are reckless and careless and you should not have a security clearance and you need to lose your job. That's certainly possible, but that's different when these charges say that you willfully retained it. You did it intentionally. You knew you were doing it, yet you still did it. And that's why oftentimes, you know, in Trump's case, it is coupled with an obstruction charge, right? They know, according to prosecutors, that he purposefully retained, willfully retained these documents because they say, we have collected ample evidence of us trying to get it back and you not. And that is not the same with Pence and Biden. In fact, it is drastically different.
I think that's really helpful to highlight the fact that it's not about a president or a former president or a former vice president who had classified documents that they shouldn't have had. The issue is you were asked for them over and over again, and you didn't give them back. You didn't accidentally pack up in a hurry and, oh my goodness, in my boxes, I have these documents I shouldn't have had. And I appreciate that you highlighted the intent element here, because I think that is obviously key to the case. And this probably brings us to talking about the judge who's in charge of this case, Judge Eileen Cannon. I don't think that this is the thing that determines how all judges rule, but she was appointed by former President Trump at the end of his term. And she actually made a ruling in an earlier iteration of this case before she was assigned the case. Could you remind us what happened in terms of, she said there should be a special master. She was ultimately overturned by the 11th Circuit, but there were concerns about Judge Cannon before she even got the case.
Right. And like, you know, it's hard to know exactly what she's thinking and what she's doing. And right, this is what we call a SEPA case. That's that is the acronym for this law that governs cases with classified documents. These are particularly complicated cases that have a lot more rules at, and I'm sorry, they govern kind of trials, right? So like, how do you use these classified documents? How do you present them to a jury in court when, you know, they don't have clearance? So these are all the laws. And so these are more complicated cases than most cases that go to trial. And they typically have a longer time before they go to trial. And, you know, you often have judges, like I talk to SEPA experts that say, you know, the first time you do a SEPA case, it's going to be hard. The second time it's going to be hard. By the third time, maybe you get a little better at it. And so she doesn't have experience in these. So, and these are slower cases to begin with, but obviously, we have some evidence of some interesting, weird things that she has done that really do stray from the judge. But I do think it's important for people to understand that, you know, this isn't the run-of-the-mill case that goes to trial and that these usually do take longer to go to trial. To your question about the special master, so that's the decision that before he was indicted, before she was assigned the case, Trump asked for basically a special master. This is kind of an outside arbiter to sift through. So again, sorry, let me take it one back. This was in between the time that they executed the search warrant and collected the remaining boxes at Mar-a-Lago and the time that he was indicted. What Trump asked for was this outside arbiter to kind of sift through all the materials, all the government materials, to say like what he had access to, which he was privileged information. And this really relied on a very heavy notion of kind of executive privilege, meaning privileges that you have as a president. So he was relying in his argument on a very definition that you have strong, these privileges extend to after you leave the White House, and they are very strong. So she ruled in his favor. It was fairly controversial because a lot of people thought he didn't have a strong case for that. And on the implications of it, people are like, oh God, this could really slow down the investigation and the case, right? He hadn't been indicted yet. And then what we saw is that she was like quickly and unanimously overturned by the conservative appeals court that she reports to. And so
the fact that that happened, I mean, I don't think any judge wants, it's kind of considered as kind of a big L if you get wholly overturned like that and they kind of say your arguments don't make sense.
Right. That her conclusions are just not based on the law and based on, in my view, a fundamental misunderstanding of what executive privilege actually means. And you use some words that I'd like to pick up on. You said it's interesting. She's done some interesting and weird things. And maybe just to get us into this topic, I'm wondering, what is your experience in terms of covering this trial and covering a trial that Judge Eileen Cannon is presiding over, maybe in comparison to other trials? Are there things about her style where, again, you're not saying it's good or bad, but where it's notably similar or different to other cases that you've covered?
Right. Look, I think that the way I think about it is that it is a defense attorney's job, right, to kind of throw everything the thing they can against the wall for their client to get the case going, to get their case dismissed. So they have all these far-fetched theories, some of them stronger. Obviously, look at this immunity challenge that is up at the Supreme Court. Clearly, Trump was right to file that one if you're on his side and want him to get that case dismissed, meaning if you're lawyers, that they did a good job on that. So that is their job. And Trump has, just like many other criminal defendants, Trump has filed a whole lot of motions to dismiss in this case, and a whole lot of just kind of motions in general for extra hearings, for extra, add extra scrutiny to the way the government did things. Now, that in itself, I mean, I guess from what I can tell, that is a normal thing for criminal defendants to do. Some of his arguments, you may say, they are so politicized, that is so Trumpian, that is not normal the way the language is written. Sure, you can make that argument. Now, Cannon, she has rejected all of his motions to dismiss. Now, that, I would say, is aligned. Her rulings are aligned in these motions to dismiss as to what most judges would do, would be to reject them. But what gets a little quirky or odd, or, I mean, you know, we've heard a lot heavier criticism, and you can use what words you want about what she's doing, is that she is holding hearings on these motions to dismiss. And she's holding hearings on a lot of other of Trump's small requests, like to hold a hearing. She held some sort of hearing last week to see if she should hold a hearing on Trump wanting to do an evidentiary type hearing on whether investigators falsified the search warrant at Mar-a-Lago. She held a hearing on what I think is safe to say is a far-fetched motion to dismiss the indictment against him based on what Trump has called the illegal appointment and funding of Jack Smith. So all of these hearings, you know, keep running the clock. They take up a lot of time, and you know, it does also suggest that at the very least, she is entertaining these ideas. She's asking hard questions of both sides, but she is taking Trump's arguments very seriously. Sometimes I think even Trump's lawyers are surprised by it. That's just me listening to some of them, looking at their responses to some of her questions, or maybe Waltine Nada's lawyers are surprised by some of them. So, you know, that is what has been really odd. She's hold, and it's been creating these backlog of key decisions that she needs to make that have ultimately, I think we can very clearly say, has delayed the trial, right? It was supposed to happen in May. That was the original time. And now she has indefinitely postponed it and didn't get in a whole calendar of all these other hearings that she's holding before then she even decides when the case will go to trial.
Right. And I do not practice in federal court, but my memory of clerking in federal court is that everything is set by the trial date and then you move backwards. So when you take a trial date off calendar, even if it's an aspirational trial date, then it does fundamentally, I'll say, change the pace of the case. And I think you laid this out very clearly that even if she's not ruling in favor of the former president, that entertaining all of the arguments and putting them up for a hearing and, you know, time for motion practice is a delay. And in my view, any delay is good for the former president. And again, my view on that is based on the first thing you said, which is, I think this is the case they were most concerned about, they meaning Trump. And so if this case doesn't go to trial before the election, which it won't, that seems like a big win for him. I think it might feel somewhat abstract to people when they hear us say lots of hearings on issues where maybe somebody else would say, well, no, that argument doesn't hold any water. And you mentioned that you thought maybe even Trump's attorneys were surprised at times. So one of the most recent hearings, as you mentioned, was about this idea that special counsel Jack Smith was not constitutionally appointed to his job. And I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit more background on what that argument is and how the hearing went.
Yeah, so that one seemed to be, so they did two separate hearings, one on the constitutionality of the appointment and one on the constitutionality of the funding of it. They were all in one filing. She held two separate hearings on it. And the main thing on the funding, on the appointment, that was the first hearing, is Trump's attorneys were basically like, this is a position that needs to be approved by the Senate, meaning Jack Smith should have been Senate confirmed. Now, their argument on this, I mean, they did a lot of arguments, but the one that I thought was their primary one that they focused on a lot was that he was they were quoting, I mean, and this is rich because they've always said, like, they want Garland to have less involvement. Like, Trump has always said he should be less involved because he's he is part of the Biden administration. He was appointed by Biden, even though we know that the relationship historically between the DOJ and the White House is historically more distant than that, and that in other, you know, agencies in the government, particularly when it comes to criminal prosecutions. But what they were saying is, like, they said, well, Garland keeps going up and telling Congress that, you know, this is an independent investigation. Jack Smith is in charge, or Jack Smith has, you know, the runway to operate an independent investigation. And then Trump's lawyers were saying, well, if he's so independent, then that makes him what is we call in government a superior officer. And that means that he should be Senate approved. Now, what the special counsel said, who was arguing it on Jack Smith's team, was saying, look, no, read the regulations. The regulations say that Garland can weigh in on certain things. Like, he is supposed to be read in on kind of significant turns in the case. He can have review of it. So it's not like he doesn't provide any oversight. And what Cannon really wanted to ask was, well, how much oversight has he provided? Did he sign off on the indictment? And, you know, I think this was what we call a non-evidentiary hearing. So they are not obligated to talk about the specifics of the case. They're more tasked with talking about the broader legal theories and arguments. And Cannon seemed, you know, to be interested in that, asking how much Garland was involved. But she also kind of seemed to say, well, I mean, there's been a lot of other special counsels appointed. It seems that precedent is on the side of the special counsel on this one, meaning the prosecutors, and acknowledge that it would be a tall order for her to overturn that precedent.
Which is why I think it's curious that she had the hearing at all, in the sense that, yes, the Supreme Court has not weighed in on this question of a special counsel and whether or not they need to be appointed and confirmed. But there is plenty of precedent and plenty of practice to indicate that we all understand that a special counsel is an inferior officer. But as you noted, she has entertained a number of these hearings. Is there something else where you want people to understand that, again, I was struck by your words that things were interesting and weird. Is there something else that happened in court where you feel like maybe people who are doing their best to follow the case but aren't living and breathing it, where you think it's important for us to know about this as a development in the case, for instance?
Right. And I want to say weird in that, like, how many hearings she is holding, how many incremental hearings she is holding.
Right.
You know, I think one thing that I do think there's obviously a narrative, you know, people aren't in the courtroom, right? I mean, I am lucky I am, but the average person, because one, there's only a limited number of seats, who's driving to Fort Pierce to see this trial, and, you know, everyone's got lives. But you know, I think like she does her homework while she's there. She's asking a lot of detailed and smart questions. Now, you can question the premise of like, should we have these hearings at all? But she is asking questions. I mean, I think some people would say it doesn't seem like a typical district court trial. Maybe it sounds more like appeals questions. I mean, even the DOJ put up their appellate lawyer there. But she is asking questions. She is doing, you know, of the hard questions of both sides. I think that. But she really is willing to, not only willing to, but she seems to really enjoy digging into the legal minutia. Like, we are deep in the weeds at a Cannon hearing. So
yes, and there's been a lot of good reporting from you and others about how deep in the weeds. I think the title of one of your recent articles was Stuck in the Weeds. And it really does help to bring us in. As you mentioned, not a lot of people obviously are going down there to that court, sitting inside the court. And is there something where you feel like reading your reporting, while it's invaluable, it does not bring us inside? Is there something about being there that you wish we understood, like in how she commands the room or how Trump's attorneys argue or the special counsel? But reading about it is hugely helpful. And being in there, I assume, is different in the sense of everybody who's deeply reporting on it is in that room.
Right. Right. Definitely. I think that, you know, it does operate like a, you know, we hear a lot about how behind the scenes frustrations. I mean, it does operate like a courtroom in order. I think we reported this, but I don't know how much it captures, just kind of how much sometimes tension there is between her and the prosecutors. I mean, she seems to get quite frustrated with them when they, you know, she feels like they are being disrespectful or interrupting. And a lot of that may be because, like I think they are more frustrated than Trump's lawyers, right? So they have more opportunity in there to be frustrated. I think one of them in particular, as we noted, this last hearing, David Harback, a prosecutor on the special counsel team, did a lot of the arguing. And there were a few times where she said, like, I think we've been through this before, but I need you to show decorum. Like, don't interrupt me. Like, this is, if you can't show decorum, then one of my colleagues can do it. Or maybe one, I'm sorry, maybe one of your colleagues can argue instead of you. You know, he apologized and he was like, I'm sorry, whatever. But, and then at the end, you know, he seemed really, this was a separate hearing, but this was the last hearing on a day of like almost five hearings over three consecutive days on Tuesday. He was arguing that this was about issues related to the way allegations from Trump that the special counsel, or at the time it wasn't the special counsel, that investigators did not properly fill out the affidavit and the ultimately the search warrant or put misleading claims on it. And so at the end, I mean, it seemed like, you know, he was getting frustrated and Cannon was trying to end the hearing and he goes, can I make one more comment? She said, like, yes, like make it quick. And he was like, they're trying to hijack the hearing. And she was like, there is no hijacking. This hearing is over. And he ended it by being like, it's not fair. So, you know, that they seem really frustrated with her. I don't know, you know, what that looks like behind the scenes or how they're, if how much of what they're portraying is intentional or not. But it does seem that they are frustrated with one another.
Yes. Sometimes it's bravado, sometimes it's real. But in my view of looking at the case from not inside the courtroom, there are plenty of reasons why you can imagine that any prosecutor would be frustrated by maybe not even every ruling, but the speed of the case. So you really helped to bring us inside this case, I think, explain what is happening in. My final question, is there something that you want us to be looking out for in the short term when it comes to this Mar-a-Lago case?
I think on July 22nd, we're going to have a scheduling hearing. So if you are curious about a trial date, then again, I don't know, but that could be where it comes. She generally, one other interesting thing about her is that I haven't seen her yet rule from the bench. So most of the time she'll have a hearing and then, you know, do a written ruling after. So I don't, you know, who's to say if we'll actually get, maybe scheduling's one where you can do it there, but like, who's to say if we'll get an actual hearing or date on July 22nd or if we'll get it later. But I mean, it seems pretty unlikely that given the schedule she's presented, it could happen before the election. But I guess we'll definitely know for sure after this hearing where her head is at with that. So timing on this case is the big question right now.
Well, and of course, timing matters because if former President Trump becomes current President Trump again, I believe he would order his attorney general to dismiss the case. A judge would have to bless that, but one can imagine that a judge would bless that, and therefore there is no trial. And so unlike other cases, I think the electoral calendar and the legal calendar have really collided, are coinciding, whatever word we want to use. But on that note, Perry, I want to thank you for your time. You really brought us inside and described the case and helped, I think, all of us understand where we are in one of the really consequential criminal cases pending against the former president.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.